Welcome to IPI and to the Globe Observatory.
Thank you.
Some 80% of the IAEA membership consists of states that do not operate a nuclear energy program. And in many cases, their driving force to become members are the major development challenges related to chronic hunger, human health, water resource management, lack of reliable energy, and so forth. Could you describe to us the IAEA's development mandate and more specifically the contribution of the technical cooperation branch?
Thank you, and we're happy to be here. I just wish to recall that it was back in November 57 to be exact, in the General Assembly that President Eisenhower raised the issue of atoms for peace. And the idea was that he saw nuclear specifically as a way of helping lots of countries deal with issues like health, food, agriculture, in fact, water management, the kind of things you just raised. These were all the issues that basically impacted on development, and these were essential things because life is water. So these are the kinds of things we President Eisenhower was referring to. And from our part, we have the agency has facilities where we do research and develop techniques for application of nuclear technology for development. And the role specifically of the TC, our mandate, is to take this from the labs and bring it to the people. We are the face of the agency at the national level. We bring these techniques to member states to help them develop. We have 151 member states, out of which 130, around that number, participates in the projects that we implement. So basically, this is what the mandate of the TC department vis-a-vis the agency as a whole, our ability to bring this technology to member states to facilitate, to assist them in their development.
You mentioned water, and obviously finding reliable access to clean and healthy water is becoming a major challenge, not only for development, but in preventing conflicts in different parts of the world. What contribution in the area of water security can the nuclear technologies offered by the IAEA make?
I think I would like to put this in perspective and to see how important our work is. I would like to provide you with our audience with some statistics. Globally, the water available, I'm talking all kinds of water, including sea, saline and all of that, 97% of the water on the surface of the earth is seawater or saline water or some kind of not pure drinkable water. 97%, more than 97%. Indication that means that only just below 3% of this is actually potable water. And out of this 3%, 68% of that is found in the Arctic, Antarctic, or as frozen ice on the Alps and Kilimanjaro and the Everest and all those things. So only out of all of that, only just about 3% is the water that we have, we use. Now, if you take that percentage, 30% of that water is underground. You see, so we have 68%, which is frozen, and out of that 30%, of what is left is underground. And only about 0.3%, 0.03% is what you find in fresh water lakes and so on. So about 300 times more of that water is underground. Now, then we bring in the agency. What do? We use isotope hydrology techniques to determine the extent of this underground water. We can indicate or can determine whether this is what we call fossil water. In other words, water that has been there for centuries or even tens of thousands of years. For example, in the Sahel region of the Sahara, we know there are lots of underground aquifers, but we don't know how long they've been there. Whether they are fossil fuels, in other words, a limited resource. There's no replenishment. If you use it, it is finished. But we also know that we have the Lake Chad and also Niger River, the River Niger, So there may be possibilities of catchment areas where the aquifers are being replenished. This technology will permit us to determine all of this and also find ways and means of sustainably training and teaching people there to use it. If it is fossil, we have to know that it's not coming back. You use it, it's gone. If it is replenishable, we can deal with issues like irrigation. Because the other thing that is important to also mention here is 70% of drinkable water, potable water, is used for irrigation. And it is so inefficiently used that 60% of this 70% is a runoff. Either it goes into the sea or it goes into back into evaporates as rain, comes back as rain, or it goes into the aquifers. The problem is, if you use this in combination with fertilizers, the runoff goes into the sea, it pollutes the sea, or the aquifers down. And once you pollute the sea, this leads to things like algae bloom, or what do some people call it, red tide, that kills fish. That is also poisonous for anybody who eats the fish. So the work that we do in determining these, the extent of these water resources is extremely important.
Could you speak a little bit more about, if we turn to water and oceans, what the IAEA does in protecting marine biological systems and environments, some of the issues you were mentioning?
We have a lab in Monaco, and this lab does lots of research into ocean pollution. And I just mentioned red tide. This is a result of pollutants going into the water. We keep track on what is happening in the water. And recently, a lot of work we're doing is concentrating on what we call ocean acidification. Ocean acidification, it must be recalled that the oceans are carbon dioxide sinks. They absorb a lot of carbon dioxide. So if you have excess of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it means more of it is going into the sea. So increasingly, the sea is becoming acidic. And the result of that is that it's destroying coral reefs. But as you know, we know that coral reefs is where fish take protection from predators. And especially a lot of fish that grow to become the food that we eat, take shelter there. So the reefs don't exist. The chances are that we have shortages of food from the sea, ocean, fish. It's also very tough on shellfish, like crabs, the kind of things that people exotically like, you know, shellfish, crabs, shrimps, and lobsters. It's very difficult on them. So we are doing modeling on this, increasing the acidity to see what the impacts are. Because at the moment, nobody can predict how these changes are going to be. So we just have to keep a bit slightly ahead of the curve to make sure that when something like this happens, we will at least either have the technology to prevent it or at least to remediate what we have. So that's one area that we also work.
Obviously, water scarcity is closely related to food security. And in a world facing dilemmas of rapid population growth, changing climate, and an increased demand for crops and livestock, what is the role of nuclear technology in relation to food security?
Well, again, we have a lab which we jointly run with Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO. And it is only about 45 minutes by car from our headquarters. Now, there we use nuclear techniques to look for new species of grains, rice or wheat or others, which will, for example, less susceptible to drought conditions or to flood conditions. As you know, recently the floods in Thailand destroyed almost the whole rice crop. Now, there are species that could stay in standard water for 1 month, 2 months, and still produce grain for consumption. So our research goes into this kind of situation. And also in the Sahel region in Africa, you know, rice or other species that are not so susceptible to drought could also be available. The other thing is when it comes to animal, like cattle and chicken, birds, you know, these things that we do. During the floods, either they migrated because they were running away. They don't want to sit. Either most of them drowned. The owners lost control of them and they migrated over. What this brings is potential transmission, transfer of diseases from one region to the next. I mean, things like foot and mouth disease, which is very, very infectious and can wipe out cattle population anywhere. And so we also have the issue of bird flu, which is not only for birds, can also be dangerous for human beings. This technology we have could trace and keep track on where these things are, where they are going. If you want to test for, say, a pathogen and standard procedures, you do a culture, it stays for a while, and then you go back and see what it is. This technology can instantly tell you what the pathogen is and how to deal with it. So here again, it's a very powerful technology, which could help us keep ahead of food production and things that are necessary for human sustainability.
Further on agriculture and food crops, could you tell us a little bit more about the so-called inherited sterility technique and the use of radiation to radiate large number of insects?
Yeah, we prefer to call it sterile insect technique. What it involves is that we use radiation techniques to render things like Mediterranean fruit fly impotent, and the male cannot reproduce. So after we breed them, we release them in the field. They will mate with what they find there, except they will not reproduce. If you continue doing this iterative process, you will be able to wipe out the species. Mediterranean fruit fly is one of the most economically difficult for countries that have infestations to deal with. And we have one, for example, a very important example of cooperation, even with even political difficulties, a project dealing with the Mediterranean med fly and involving Israel, Palestine, and Jordan. Because you cannot wipe out the flies in Israel and leave Palestine and Jordan. They just come back. So they are cooperating, sitting together and doing this project to wipe out this fly that is economically very, very devastating. And then in Africa, Ethiopia now, we're doing something on tsetse fly. Again, tsetse fly, as you know, can lead to sleeping sickness and also is very devastating for livestock. And some years ago, we managed to wipe out tsetse fly from Zanzibar. It is an island off the coast. It's part of Tanzania, but it's off the coast of the Tanzanian coast. The thing with it is that it's an isolated place, so it's easy to wipe it out, and not so easily reinfested. In the case of Ethiopia, we're doing it in the Rift Valley because it's surrounded by high mountains. So it's the possibility of wiping them out without reinfestation is very good. You see, the use of this technique is because it is benign. The alternative is aerosol spray, which could be polluting the environment and other things. But this is benign, it's between the insects themselves. They wipe each other out. So it is a very powerful tool for this particular situation.
Are these techniques also applicable to malaria?
We are looking into malaria and also dengue fever. Of course, same mosquitoes, but what they do are different. The pathogens they carry are different. And we are doing experiments on this to see how this could be applied for infested, especially the tropics. And I think in South America, I think it's in Panama, we have a facility where we're using this for dengue fever. it is Guatemala where we are applying these techniques. But again, it's the mosquitoes that carry these diseases. They are very resilient. So one way of, instead of spraying, you're using their own genetic makeup to destroy it. So this is what this technology can do.
You spoke previously about areas of human health where these technologies and radiation can help. Could you speak a little bit more about the area of non-communicable diseases where nuclear radiation could help?
Well, this technology, nuclear technology, is a very powerful tool for diagnostics as well as for treatment for cancer. And I'm sure everybody has a family member that has been treated with radiation for cancer, for tumors and all that sort of. But it's not just for the treatment, for the actual treatment of the problem, but for diagnostics. It's the easiest, probably the cheapest way of determining exactly where the tumor is, its size, its makeup, and how one could get to it, either by surgery, even if you're not going to do radiation, by surgery, or by radiation treatment. It is also, it can also be used for diagnostics of heart diseases, because it can pinpoint if there's where the blockage is or where you have inflammation in the part of the heart for action either by surgery or by other techniques. It is also extremely powerful for things like nutrition, childhood nutrition, or people who are suffering from AIDS. The childhood nutrition, we can determine very quickly if the child is getting the right type of nutrients in what they are, whether breastfeeding or the kind of assistance that is provided by World Food Program or by UNICEF. One can easily check to see if the intervention is working, is providing the children with the right kinds of nutrition. For this, the cases of AIDS, for example, nutrition is a big part of the treatment because of the large cocktail of pills that they take. They have to have a certain level of nutrients to sustain the some of these very powerful drugs that they have to take. And again, this could be used to determine what sort of nutrition deficiency they may have or what they need to add to make them healthily take these medications. So here again, it's a very powerful tool.
So finally, looking into the future, are there any new cutting-edge nuclear technologies for development that you see on the rise?
Well, there are lots of things we can do, and even outside the health and food and agriculture area. But there are huge problems of malnutrition in the world. So we could, for example, work with UNICEF to develop very simple kits, for example, which could be used in the field. I mean, when people hear of nuclear techniques, they think it's a very sophisticated thing. No. For example, to see whether a mother is getting getting the baby the right milk, they just have to take a small dose of what we call very staple isotope, actually just water, an isotope of water. And then after the baby eats the breast for 2 weeks later, you go and you just use the cotton swab to, like you do for DNA testing in the mouth, and you can tell with that, you can easily determine whether the nutrition is, the child is getting the nutrition. So this is an area that we need to expand our work. But I also talked about the drought situation. And as you know, if you go to the other part of the world, Asia Pacific, their problem is flooding. And again, there's a lot of things we can do with this technology. First, to make sure that after the floods, we can determine the nutrients that are lost from the soil and how to replenish that. We can also look at even before prevention mechanisms. by first mapping out the flow of water when it is not before floods, and see what situations exist before, during the flood. So we can also use the same technology to help in this area. So we have a lot of work to do in food, for development issues, for food, for health, nutrition, different species of rice. I was in Indonesia recently, and it was in April, and it's supposed to be dry season. And for Indonesia, mango industry is big. It was dry, it's supposed to be dry season, but it was raining. But the mango only flowers during the dry season. So basically the crop was about to fail. It's not because of lack of water, but too much water. So we have to keep ahead of the curve. So a lot of research is required in this area. And I mean, what this technology does is to be able to determine footprints of things. Because if anything that is a slight, if you take water from here, as from water from Philadelphia, there are some specific stuff in Philadelphia that is different from this. You can tell where it comes from if you know the footprints of, like, the soil here and the soil over there. So there are, we were in Washington, and some suggestions even to use the technology to trace blood diamonds, because if the diamonds are formed under certain countries with maybe peculiar soil components. So you can tell, but if you know the footprint of that area, whether it came from Sierra Leone or it came from Angola or some other. And even it can also be used for timber and other things. So there is a lot of work to do in the future. You may have a maple tree here, which is totally different from Canada, because the absorption of the nutrients is not the same, the soil is not the same. So if you know what is here, you can use. So this technology can do a lot of things, over and above even nutrition and health. And things. So there's no end to this. It's very very powerful tool.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us.
You're most welcome.